The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay, I think we're ready to get started. This talk is Saudi Arabia and the U.S., the history of a special relationship, and which I think it's really interesting to me. I hope it's really interesting to all of you. And Deepa Kumar here is giving the talk. Deepa is a professor of media studies at Rutgers University. She's written several articles of the ISR, maybe people have read them, on Islamophobia, Hamas, on U.S. imperialism. And she's the author of an upcoming book, it's not out yet, but called Allies and Enemies, Political Islam, U.S. Policy and the Media. So without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to Deepa.
Okay. It's really cold, so I'm going to sit down. If people can't see me, you know, I'll get up at some point. So some of you may have noticed that since the events of 9/11, and when particularly it was learned that 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi Arabian, Saudi Arabia has been all over the news, right? In fact, the amount of critical scrutiny that Saudi Arabia has been put through over the last few years far exceeds anything that we've seen in the 56-year relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. So much so, Saudi bashing has become something of a spectator sport. Now, we've heard a slew of criticisms from the right, particularly from the neoconservatives. We've also heard criticisms from centrist and moderate talk show hosts, as well as conservatives. And finally, even figures from the left, like Michael Moore in the film Fahrenheit 9/11, you may remember that. Now, what are they criticizing Saudi Arabia for? Now, on the right, you know, some people have suddenly discovered human rights and women's rights and have condemned Saudi Arabia for violations of the same. Never mind, of course, that these people actually don't give a hoot about human rights and women's rights right here in this country. But the crux of their argument is that Saudi Arabia has become a problem for the U.S. and therefore the U.S. should sever links with that country. So this is what Richard Perle, a leading neocon, had to say in National Review, the right-wing rag that you may have come across. He basically said, quote, "I think it's a disgrace. The Saudis are a major source of the problem we face with terrorism," end quote, and so on. And this is why the U.S. should end its relationship. Similarly, a representative of the RAND Corporation made a presentation where he argued that Saudi Arabia is, quote, "the kernel of evil, the prime mover, the most dangerous opponent," end quote, of the U.S. in the Middle East. An ex-CIA agent by the name Richard Bauer has a book called Sleeping with the Enemy, and he suggests that Saudi Arabia is, quote, "a powder keg waiting to explode, end quote, and that the U.S. will, quote, "have to consider seizing the oil fields," end quote. Now, Michael Moore, so this is the tenor of the criticisms, and unfortunately, Michael Moore added to this chorus of conservative voices in his film Fahrenheit 9/11 by putting forward what I think is really a very simplistic and somewhat conspiratorial analysis of the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. Now, in all of this chatter, what is missing is a real history of the relationship between these two countries and how it has impacted politics around the region and around the world. Now, I'll say that it is true that the criticisms of Saudi Arabia are true. Saudi Arabia does oppress minorities, religious minorities in particular. They severely punish all forms of dissent. They give little or absolutely no voting rights to their citizens. And in fact, women continue to be disenfranchised in that country. But what is missing in the highlighting of these factors is the active role that the U.S. has played in not only supporting, but even helping Saudi Arabia to stay this way. So I want to start then by briefly explaining the nature of the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. In a nutshell, the so-called special relationship is based on oil and security. The U.S. needs to control the oil in the region, and Saudi Arabia needs the U.S. to shore up its defense capabilities, both to put down external threats as well as to put down internal threats to the rule of the Al Saud family. In short, this is a relationship between the ruling classes of two nations based on mutual interests. And during the Cold War, there were two more reasons why this relationship and alliance was struck. One had to do with the fact that Saudi Arabia was actually a very strategic location for the United States in the context of the Cold War, and I'll say a little more about that later. And two, Saudi Arabia's ambition of becoming this Islamic pole of attraction to act as a counter against the secular nationalists that were then quite popular, people like Nasser, who again I'll talk about a little bit more. Saudi Arabia wanted to become a dominant regional hegemon, if you will. That goal coincided with the US's policy in the Middle East. They too wanted to marginalize the secular and leftist forces, and so they came together with Saudi Arabia. The area that is called Saudi Arabia used to be part of the Ottoman Empire. And in fact, for about 2.5 centuries, the Al Saud family had been trying to conquer all of the Arabian Peninsula and set up a kingdom. And the story actually begins in 1744 in the town of Najd in central Arabia, where a minor prince by the name Muhammad bin Saud made an alliance with a controversial Islamic scholar named Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab. And the basis of this alliance was that the Saud family, would rule politically, while the Wahhabis and the descendants of Al-Wahhab are known as the Al-Al-Sheikh, they would rule in the area of social activities and in the religious domain and so on. So that was the basis of this alliance. Now, given this alliance, there were two attempts made to create a Saudi Wahhabi state, but both failed. They were defeated by the Ottomans. And it was really only in the early 20th century, and with the help of the British, that Ibn Saud was able to realize a Saudi state. Now, the British had actually been making incursions into Ottoman territory for a while, and the discovery of oil, particularly in the context of the Second World War, made this region even more important to them. And the Saud family's national aspirations coincided with the British with the British aims to destabilize the Ottomans. So you see the two coming together. And so in 1915, the British formalized their relationship with Ibn Saud. They did this by conferring a knighthood on him, and they also gave him a little allowance of £5,000 a month. So that was the beginning of their relationship. Now, with the green light from the Brits, the Saud family undertook a period of conquest until the territory that is today known as Saudi Arabia was brought under their control. Now, to succeed in putting down all resistance to their rule, Ibn Saud created a religious army known as the Ikhwan, who were these Bedouin warriors who were really sort of imbued with Wahhabi doctrine and philosophy. And the Ikhwan was so merciless, if you will, so fanatical, that they killed and maimed people. Any form of resistance was met with the utmost brutality. Now, 400,000, it is estimated that 400,000 people were killed or wounded in this war for conquest. Additionally, in provinces where Ibn Saud had appointed governors, there were 40,000 public executions and 350,000 amputations, and that was the cost of actually subduing the peninsula and creating the state. And of course, the Shia population was dealt with very ruthlessly. Their leadership was practically decimated, thousands were killed, and so forth. Now, I raise all of this to make a very simple point, and that is that the state of Saudi Arabia comes into being not as a product of a national liberation struggle against the Ottomans, but rather as a project of territorial conquest led by a monarchical class with the help of the British Empire. So it's important to keep that in mind when we look at the foundations of Saudi Arabia. All right, so I said earlier, the state comes into being in 1932. And in many ways, it was an anomaly. It's the only country where the territory of the nation was considered the property of a royal family, right? Mm-hmm. Because Saudi Arabia, it's the Arabia of the Saudis, isolated from the rest of the world. I mean, there was trade and the ports and so on, but inland there was a high degree of isolation. And the result of all of this is that the dominant mode of production and the social relations in the Arabian Peninsula had really been the same over the last few centuries. And here's how one economist described Saudi Arabia at the time, quote, "Before the development of the oil industry, the main sources of the Saudi population's livelihood were pastoral and trade. Inhabitants of the interior of the country were mainly pastoralists, raising goats, sheep, and camels. Settled agriculture was present in Asir in the Oasis area of Al-Hasa. The inhabitants of the small towns were mainly engaged in commercial and artisanal activities. There was virtually no industry. The traditional economy was generally based on a complex of small self-sufficient units, the largest boundaries of which were those of oasis, village, or tribe. The social characteristics which accomplished this form of economic life were those of relative poverty, a high level of illiteracy, and substantial isolation from developments outside of the local area. So that's, in a nutshell, what Saudi Arabia was like in 1932. And who lived there? Well, 40% of the people who lived in that region were Bedouins. They were nomadic. And another 50% were involved in agriculture, pastoralism, trade, commerce, and so forth. That is, 50% were settled, 40% were nomadic. And it's onto this kind of society that the Saud family sort of grafted their version of a state based on Wahhabi principles. What did that mean in practice? Well, the Quran became the nation's constitution, and Wahhabi social codes were instituted onto the population. So for instance, smoking was prohibited. There was a dress code for both women and men too were severely punished if they didn't have their beards at a certain length. Music was outlawed, and for some reason for the Wahhabis, brightly colored flower pots were offensive, so they were smashed and destroyed. And you know, you get a sense of the kind of austere social codes that were put into place, and there was a religious police that was set up in order to enforce these codes. Now, the state had very little resources. What they got in terms of money coming into the state was from the Hajj, which is the pilgrimage to Mecca and Medina that that Muslims make. They got money from customs duty and a little bit from tax. Electricity, by the way, was very rudimentary. Telephone and telegraph was rare. And there was really no semblance of a nation state in the true sense until the mid-1950s. And Ibn Saud basically ruled like a Bedouin chief with only a sort of rudimentary administration. So the division of labor was, you know, the political arena would be under the control of Ibn Saud and the Saud family. And the Wahhabi establishment took care of religious needs, Sharia courts and laws, and the white army maintained security. Now, given the state of affairs, Fred Halliday, in a really excellent book that I want to recommend, it's called Arabia Without Sultans, given the state of affairs, here's what Fred Halliday had to say. He said, quote, "On its own, this regime was an unstable anachronism. It required outside support to survive. It also thwarted all progressive reform movements that could have taken the country in another direction." And I'm going to lay that out a little bit in a short while. So I said earlier that the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia begins in 1933. And of course, this is a relationship based on oil. Standard Oil of California struck a deal to do oil exploration. Oil had not yet been discovered in Saudi Arabia at this stage. And SoCal actually struggled until 1938 to try to find oil in the region. And then in 38, they actually were able to find oil. And then SoCal merges with this company called Texas Oil, and in 1944, they renamed their subsidiary Arab American Company, or Aramco. Now, Aramco is really a crucial name to remember, because Aramco serves as the intermediary in many ways between the United States and Saudi Arabia. They provide legal assistance, they provide communication assistance, and all sorts of things to the Saudi royal family. Right. Now, when oil was discovered in 1938 in modest proportions, it was actually only in 1948 that Aramco struck gold, literally. They discovered the world's largest oil deposit in 1948, and from then on, Saudi Arabia came onto the world scene as a serious oil player. Right. Now, in the early 30s and 40s, that is before, you know, oil money started to come in, Saudi Arabia was actually in really dire financial straits. The king needed $10 million a year to run the country, and of course, Britain and the United States were more than happy to supply this money. But the US quickly realized that they actually had to axe Britain out of any sort of contact with Saudi Arabia, because keep in mind that coming out of the First World War, the US enters the Middle East in a situation where Britain has control over all the key sources of oil and so forth. And so they've got to intervene. And this is actually why SoCal makes an independent deal with Saudi Arabia, because they couldn't quite get into the consortium and play by Britain's rules and so on. So the US realizes that in the context of Saudi Arabia, they've got to axe Britain out. Otherwise, their control over Saudi oil would be threatened. And so in 1943, what did they do? Hold on a second. So in 1943, this became an issue of policy concern and so on. And here's how the US decided they're going to view Saudi Arabia. They said, quote, "The defense of Saudi Arabia is vital to the defense of the United States," end quote. And this is also around the same time that a State Department official proclaimed that Saudi Arabia is the greatest material prize in world history. And of course, the United States was going to do everything it could to guard that prize and keep it for itself. So how did it do that? Well, right away, a US military mission arrived in Saudi Arabia to train the Saudi army, and they built an airfield in Dhahran. Now, Dhahran is strategic not only in that it's close to oil fields and oil wells, but it was also it was also an independent base for the United States in the region, right? Otherwise, they had to go to British bases in order to carry out their attacks and so on, sorts of ways. Now, it wasn't actually used as a combat zone until after the Cold War, but in general, and I won't go into too many details, it was very strategically important for the US to place troops there to have a presence in Saudi Arabia. All right. Now, while the Dhahran Air Base was being constructed, FDR and Ibn Saud met on a US warship in the Red Sea in 1945 in what is now considered to be a historic meeting. And FDR basically pledged the US's support for Saudi Arabia, guaranteed its territorial integrity, and promised not to carry out any acts that were hostile to the Arabs. And in fact, between 1940 and 1947, the US gave Saudi Arabia $99 million in aid. Okay, now after FDR comes Truman. Truman only strengthens the relationship, and he entered into a series of military agreements which actually have laid the groundwork for the kind of US training of Saudi forces that continue even today. So that started under the Truman administration. He also increased direct financial aid, and he worked out this sort of shady situation where Aramco would pay less taxes in the United States and give more profits to Saudi Arabia. So Truman was perfectly happy to do what he could to bolster Saudi Arabia. And of course, in return for this military and financial assistance, Saudi Arabia offered political support for the US's activities in the region. And Truman actually was very thrilled by Ibn Saud's sort of anti-communist credentials. Here's what Ibn Saud is known to have said. He said, quote, "If you find a communist in Saudi Arabia, I will hand you his head," end quote. And of course, this was completely delightful for the US in the midst of the Cold War. Now, this is how Truman put it. He said that the US was interested in the preservation of the independence and territorial integrity of Saudi Arabia, and no threat to your kingdom could occur which would not be a matter of immediate concern to the United States. So that's how Truman, the Truman administration, viewed Saudi Arabia. And indeed, this is how various administrations have responded as well every time a threat was posed. And these are not just, as I said earlier, external threats, but even internal threats. So when oil workers went on strike in the 1950s, and I'll come to that again, the very same military that the US trains is used to put down these strikes. And of course, Saudi Arabia has shown its gratitude by advancing the US's interests around the world. You know, it does the dirty work that the US wants done for it. So for instance, Saudi Arabia was one of the key players in funding the Afghan Mujahideen in the war with the Soviet Union. They've also funneled money to groups that are pro-US in countries like Angola. They gave money to the Contras in Nicaragua. Similarly, a number of countries in the Horn of Africa. So really, like Israel, Saudi Arabia has done the US's dirty work in exchange for financial and military support. Okay, so now I want to step back and paint a snapshot of what the Middle East looked like in the 1950s. The broad context was the Cold War, that is the rivalry between the US and the Soviet Union, and who would dominate the world. Now, of these, the secular nationalist movement of Nasser in Egypt was one that in fact inspired and transformed the politics of the region. Nasserism became something to aspire to for people in the Middle East. Now, at first, the United States thinks it can co-opt Nasser. They try to do that. They even try to co-opt Mossadegh in Iran. But when that fails, they start to turn against these forces, and they see secular nationalists as enemy number one. And of course, they also, if you're not allied with the United States, then they saw these countries as falling into the Soviet camp. The Eisenhower Doctrine is a response to this situation. In essence, it argues that the Soviet Union has designs on the Middle East, and therefore the US is willing to, quote, secure and protect the territorial integrity and political independence of nations requesting such aid against overt armed aggression from any nation controlled by international communism, end quote. And you know, for the book, I'm doing some research on media coverage of all of this, and there's a Time magazine cover with all these tiny little Arab states and so forth, and this big, huge bear coming to gobble it up, you know. And that's really sort of the visual representation of the Eisenhower Doctrine. At any rate, in pursuing this aim, Saudi Arabia became even more important to the United States. And policymakers in Washington actually started to see King Saud, this is Ibn Saud's son, Ibn Saud had died in the mid-50s, King Saud, who replaced him, they started to see him as a counterweight to Nasser. And the logic was basically this within the State Department, that is, they wanted to create Saudi Arabia, which was the home to the holiest sites of Islam, Mecca and Medina. They wanted to use Islam, basically, as a sort of ideological glue to create a bulwark against secularism and leftist politics and so on in the region. And in fact, the terminology they used is they want to create an Islamic Pope who can act as a pole of attraction away from Nasserism. Okay, now here's how one former CIA official put it. He said, quote, "The optic was the Cold War. The Cold War was the defining clarity of the time. We saw Nasser as socialist, anti-Western, anti-Baghdad pact, and we were looking for some sort of counterfoil. Saudi efforts to Islamicize the region were seen as powerful and effective and likely to succeed. We loved that. We had an ally against communism," end quote. And indeed, with the financial and military support of the US, Saudi Arabia in fact does forge ahead and Islamicize the region. How do they do this? A couple of ways. In 1962, Saudi Arabia forms the World Muslim League, and this group, this organization, sets up branches all around the world. King Faisal also brings together, after Saud comes, well, let me not do the whole history, but at this stage, let's just say King Faisal, together with a group, brought together a group of Muslim countries in the mid-60s to act as an Islamic bloc of countries against Nasserism and secular nationalism. And they're doing all these things, you know, they're putting all this they're starting these processes. But it's really only after 1967, when Egypt is defeated in the Six-Day War with Israel, that Saudi Arabia actually begins. Now, all of this is taking place in a context where oil prices are just going through the roof. Oil prices have rose dramatically in a short three-year period between 1970 and 1973. Oil prices go through the roof. And flush with this money, the Saud family is able to advance this agenda of Islamicizing not just the Middle East, but even North Africa, South Asia, and so on. A couple of ways in which they do this. They set up a massive network of charity and good works. And what this does is it allows various Islamist groups in various countries to provide what they call Islamic solutions to the economic problems that many countries are experiencing during that time. They attract immigrant labor who then go back and take not only their newly earned wealth, but also Wahhabi philosophy with them. They use the World Muslim League to counter secularism and to print and distribute millions of Qurans. And they bring together a number of countries in the region under a grouping called the Organization of the Islamic Conference. They create a financial system called Islamic Banking, which also funds various Islamist organizations, and so on and so forth. And by some accounts, after 1979, it is estimated that Saudi Arabia spent $75 billion underwriting schools, mosques, and charity networks worldwide. In fact, if you look at the sum total of all these efforts, I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that many of the Islamist organizations that today the US, of course, considers its enemies, you know, allies become enemies when it's inconvenient, many of these groups would not have come to prominence had it not been for the role of the US. And of course, through all of this, the United States completely backed and supported Saudi Arabia, because these goals of Saudi Arabia meshed perfectly with US aims. And it's incredible. You see declassified national security documents and so on. They even go to the extent of giving the words that the king should use, you know, supplying him with printing presses. And, you know, the extent of support is quite quite interesting. All right. Now, just one quick caveat here. Now, the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States hasn't always been harmonious. You know, there have been conflicts, and I just want to mention a few of them. So, for instance, when Saudi Arabia reduced oil production in 1973 mm-hmm. and created the oil embargo, obviously the US didn't like it. And this was the point at which, by the way, they drew up their first plans to invade Saudi Arabia and take over the oil fields. These plans still exist. They keep getting modified, and they're still on the books. Similarly, you know, when Saudi Arabia got nuclear ballistic missile capabilities from China in 1988, the US didn't like it. Similarly, on the question of, you know, Palestine, there have been some conflicts, some rhetorical, some real, and so on. So these sorts of tensions have existed, but on the whole, really the relationship has only grown stronger over the years. So now we come to the Johnson administration. Under Johnson, Saudi Arabia came to be seen as, quote, a reliable partner in the struggles against Nasserism and communism, end quote. But it was really Carter, you know, the liberal Democrat Carter, who took the strongest position in support of Saudi Arabia by any means necessary, including military force, end quote. So here we have it. Eisenhower, the Republican, promises aid. Carter promises war. And this was really the strongest commitment of the United States to Saudi Arabia up until that point. And the question is why? What is actually happening in the world that causes Carter to take it further? Well, the previous year, 1979, two very important events occur. The first was the Iranian Revolution of 1979. The US-backed Shah was deposed by a revolution, a groundswell from below. And what happens is that the US, which relied on Iran as being one of its pillars to do its bidding in that region, one of those pillars have crumbled. And therefore, they turn to Saudi Arabia even more, because they need them even more to act as a proxy and to serve as a counterforce, using their version of Islamist politics as opposed to Iran. That is to say, if Iran represented a certain kind of Islamist politics, the US now needed Wahhabism to act as a counter to that, right? And so these events really become even more important in terms of solidifying the relationship. The other thing that happens in 1979 is that the Soviet Union invades Afghanistan, and the US actually, a few months before that, had started funding the Holy Warriors, or the Mujahideen, to repel them, to be involved in a war with the Soviets. And Saudi Arabia, of course, was central to these efforts. They not only gave funds, billions of dollars, they actually had a matching program. So dollar for dollar contributed by the US was matched by Saudi Arabia. But Saudi citizens like Osama bin Laden helped recruit people from the region. The CIA, as you know, toured him around. Several people also came to the United States and had a massive tour in the United States to recruit for the Afghan War. Now, of course, Saudi Arabians who fought in the Afghan War then, after that, returned to Saudi Arabia and started to foment resistance against the monarchy, because now they see them as sellouts, as corrupt, and so forth. And these tensions actually boil over in 1991 when the US stations troops in Saudi Arabia. And you see the birth at that point of a politicized Wahhabi Salafi movement that wants to overthrow the Saud family. But before I say anything more about the right-wing resistance to the South family. And you may have heard, right, of the Khobar bombings and all the rest of it. What's left out of the story is really that there is a history of progressive movements, there is a history of left-wing movements, and the right has come to power, has been able to organize discontent only after the left and only after the working class was crushed. So I want to, you know, talk at least a little bit about that. Now, up until the 1950s, I mentioned earlier, Saudi Arabia was a fairly underdeveloped country. But the discovery of oil meant that an oil industry was quickly developed. And in the process of doing that, a working class was also developed. And oil workers in Saudi Arabia found themselves toiling under horrible conditions. Mm-hmm. And this, of course, necessarily radicalized them. So in 1953, 13,000 oil workers in the oil fields around Dammam went on strike. And they actually went and organized a protest. They organized a demonstration against him. Now, needless to say, the monarchy actually viewed this activity by oil workers as a serious threat to their power. And they used their military, i.e. the US-trained military, to ruthlessly clamp down. Hundreds were arrested, foreign workers were deported, and a royal decree was passed under which strikes and work stoppages were banned, right? And of course, Aramco was more than happy to help the Saudi government with this. And they did so by helping the Saudi military to identify and pick out the strike leaders so that they could be arrested, tortured, et cetera, et cetera. But this actually didn't end workers' self-activity, which would break out again in 1979 in the eastern Shia oil provinces, the eastern oil-rich provinces where the Shia are a majority. Now, in addition to activities of workers, resistance to the monarchy has also come from sections of the Air Force and the military that were sympathetic to Nasserism. So for instance, in the 1960s, nine pilots defected to the Nasserites, and as a result, the entire Saudi Arabian Air Force was grounded to a halt. And then there were groups like the National Liberation Front. You can see where the inspiration for that comes from, right? It's inspiration from Vietnam and so on. Anyway, the National Liberation Front was the closest thing to a communist party that existed in Saudi Arabia. And you had nationalist groups like the Arabian Peninsula People's Union, APPU, which engaged in guerrilla warfare and whose aim was the creation of a Republic of the Arabian Peninsula, which would support the Arab movement for, quote, socialism, liberty, unity, and democracy, end quote. Now, needless to say, these movements were ruthlessly crushed by the government with the full backing of the US, because God forbid you actually have a democratic movement where people take the resources in their country and use it for themselves. Certainly that cannot be tolerated, as we saw in the case of Iran and the democratically elected leader Mossadegh. They have to be taken out, just as Mossadegh was taken out, and so on. And that's why, you know, if you look at this history, it is only after the left and progressive forces and the working class movement was crushed that you actually saw the Islamist right coming in and filling that vacuum. And the first spectacular act that they did that brought them to international prominence is when they took over the Grand Mosque in 1979. And keep in mind that at this stage, there were still workers' disruptions of various kinds that were going on in the eastern provinces, as I mentioned earlier. So that's the first point, is I really want to do away with the idea, with the myth, that somehow there is no history of, you know, progressive movements or left struggle in the Arabian Peninsula. Now today, there are all sorts of reasons why people are discontented with the rule of the Al Saud family. They have to do with the absence of political rights. They have to do with the lack of opportunities, the persecution of religious minorities, rights of women and so forth. But one of the key factors that has stayed constant over these last few years is a tremendous growth in class inequality. How much time do I
have? 5 more minutes.
Okay. Yikes, I'm not going to finish.
Do as best you can. We're enjoying it.
All right, I'm going to be quick because apparently I have less time than I thought. Right. Now, which is unfortunate because I painted such a huge picture of how underdeveloped Saudi Arabia was, and now I can't tell you the extent to which suddenly through 3-5 year plans starting in 1970, there's massive industrialization that actually starts to take place. Let me just read a quote from an economist to give you a snapshot of this. The 1970 to 85 period saw a major transformation of the Saudi economy carried through with a vision of development which had a number of key components: developing the oil industry, building up a substantial industrial base through utilizing hydrocarbon resources and energy, and promoting agriculture and a measure of agricultural self-sufficiency through the spread of irrigation, creating the social and physical infrastructure of the modern nation state, et cetera, et cetera. So there was a massive sort of, in the same way that various state capitalist societies, including in Egypt under Nasser, instituted these 5-year state-led development plans, that's what happened in Saudi Arabia as well. But all the wealth that's generated from this goes into the coffers of just the really wealthy. And at the bottom of society, in fact, class polarization begins to really show itself. Just very quickly, in terms of how the landscape undergoes changes in Saudi Arabia, in the early 60s, 92% of the workforce was Saudi. By 1970, it was down to 60%, and by 1999, only 37.5% of the workforce is Saudi. And in the same year, you see huge unemployment rates. 1999, 27% of the working population is out of a job, and the people who are most heavily hit are those with high school and college educations. And this is one section from which the Islamists draw, as well as from the conservative sections of the middle classes. All right, so where are we today? And I promise I'll come to a close with this. I'm just gonna do a quick snapshot over the last 9 years. Now, as I mentioned at the start of of my talk, after 9/11, sections of the political elite started to view Saudi Arabia as a problem, seeing it as one of the key aiders and abettors of terrorism. But the US, of course, can't just simply break ties with Saudi Arabia as long as oil remains crucial to the world economy. This is how Dick Cheney put it, and I'm paraphrasing it. He says, "Whoever controls the flow of Persian Gulf oil has a stranglehold not only on the US economy, but also on the economies of, quote, most of the other nations of the world as well." Now, I rarely find myself in a position of agreement with Dick Cheney, but I think in this he happens to actually be right. So what, according to these people who advocate a break with Saudi Arabia, what do they say, what solutions do they provide? Well, there are a number of solutions. There are those who I mentioned earlier who argue that the US should simply invade Saudi Arabia, take over the oil field, and just be done with it. Of course, that's not a plan that's likely to go over very well in the world community, and especially not now, not today, after everything that's happened in the last. The US suddenly starts to call for Shia self-determination at the same time as it's pointing guns at Iran, right? So that's another solution. Now, the third solution, which was particularly popular among the neocons, was to actually decrease the US's reliance on Saudi oil by importing more oil from post-Saddam Iraq, right? That was one of their strategies, is we'll take over Iraq, and then we have to be less dependent on Saudi Arabia. Well, as we know, that didn't quite work out either. But one of the themes that we've seen since 9/11, and you saw this actually most visibly in the 2004 election, is that both candidates, John Kerry and George Bush, unveiled their so-called energy independence programs. Now, for Kerry, this meant an investment in new technology and alternative fuels. And for Bush, it was a program of drilling in the Attic National Wildlife Reserve. And if you read, you know, people who actually study how much energy can be got from this, at what point, and so on, they find these plans completely ridiculous, because in the short term, these strategies are really not sufficient to reducing the US's need for Middle East oil. And even though in recent years the United States has actually increased its oil imports from countries like Canada, Mexico, Venezuela, and Nigeria, Saudi Arabia still figures among its top 5 suppliers. In the years 2003 and 2004, 22% of net oil imports to the United States was from the Persian Gulf, and of this, 70% came from Saudi Arabia. But even beyond the question of domestic consumption, oil still remains the key resource upon which the engine of capitalist development runs. And China's energy needs, for instance, are predicted to really just grow exponentially over the years. In fact, some predictions state that by 2010, next year, China will be importing the same amount as the United States. So what we have then is a situation where oil is a dwindling resource. So the resource is dwindling, but the demand is only going up. And in this context, the US really cannot afford to end its special relationship with the country that sits on the greatest supply of oil in the world. And there are other reasons as well for why the US can't end this relationship, which I'll only go into briefly. One has to do with the arms industry in the United States. The US has sold over $100 billion worth of arms to Saudi Arabia. At points, this has been actually very crucial for the arms industry for its well-being. There's also questions of investment. Saudi Arabia has a lot of investment in the US. The US has a lot of investment in Saudi Arabia. And particularly after 2005, when Saudi Arabia joined the WTO, even more investment opportunities have opened up, and the US would be foolish from the ruling class's point of view to actually miss out on that. And finally, in terms of political reasons, the US still needs Saudi Arabia to do its dirty work, such as fund groups opposed to Hezbollah in Lebanon, act as a counterweight to Iran, pretend to be a quote-unquote moderate voice in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and so on and so forth. And this is, of course, why, despite all the media hysteria about Saudi Arabia, President Bush made peace with King Abdullah. King Abdullah visited, and so on, and why President Obama visited Saudi Arabia before giving his historic speech to continue in this vein until the working classes of both countries and progressive forces in both countries actually take matters into their own hands and impose a different kind of agenda.
Wow, that was that's a lot of great stuff. History, analysis, politics today. We're gonna have a discussion. I think people here, we know how it works. Raise your hand, 2 or 3 minutes. Try to start at 3 minutes and see how it goes. Deepa's definitely gonna come back at the end, but if there's enough questions, we may have her come back before then. So I'll turn the floor open and just raise your hand. I'll mark your name down. Well, I don't know everybody's name. I'll just kind of point to you and describe your shirt or something. All right, we've got here in front.
I was wondering if Deepa could speak on the effects that the Saudi support, both with funds, resources, and ideological support and connection between the Saudi state and the Taliban in Afghanistan, what that has done to U.S.-Saudi relations, being that there's so much craze against the Taliban.
Okay, I've got blue shirt. No, blue cap here in the back.
I'd like to ask you, you mentioned with Nasser, with a lot of like countries in the 50s and 60s really eliminating the progressive left-wing movements that actually the role of the more part of the right-wing groups. And I was wondering if you could comment more on that transition as an overall regional issue, because I don't know, my reading and my experiences in the region, I've found that people talk about as if those systems just failed us, and so we moved more to religion as the governmental system. I've never heard that, so I'm interested.
Okay, we've got this gentleman here.
I was wondering if you could elaborate on Saudi-Israeli relationships, and also came to my attention that even the Arab communist groups were actually not opposed to the establishment of the Israeli state. You can also elaborate on that.
Oh, lots of questions already. Okay. Comrade way in back. Yeah. Yeah, you. Where aren't you?
Hey, Jonathan Ron, I actually want to ask a couple of questions too based on some stuff that you've raised. Two of them. One is what are workers' struggle right now in Saudi Arabia look like, particularly with the seems like a, you know, a brief answer to me, it has a higher necessity for an international disposition of the Olmec tradition, which leads to the second question, which is what that looks like. I know that there's some, and yes, that's a question. And then also another question, I guess, is that has there been any continuity with the struggles that did break out all throughout the Middle East when there was such clear acquiescence to the slaughter going on in Gaza? I know that there were demos in the streets in Saudi Arabia and Egypt, all over the place. Were there any consequences of that in Saudi Arabia specifically?
Let me know if anyone wants to make a
couple more.
We'll take, if there's...
Does anyone want
if
to
it's,
try to
yeah,
answer?
Yeah, if it's... Hopefully somebody will have comments or at least try to answer some of these questions, because it's a lot for Deepa. But if not, Deepa's going to come back pretty quick because the questions are building up. This, with glasses here? Mm-hmm.
As far as the left goes in the Middle East, it was, like you point out in Saudi Arabia, throughout the entirety of the Middle East, there was considered very much an effort by right-wing groups there, usually by the U.S., of course. Iran being another big example of that is when they put the Shah back in power. They, you know, it wasn't just that the government failed people. That's kind of the, they went watch their history just like we do. Most workers in the United States, don't understand their own history. And the same thing's going to be any workers anywhere. You know, they whitewash that so that they don't get that sense. They don't have that tradition. They don't have that connection. So they do say, oh, well, apparently the left failed us. That's why we don't have that. Well, no. They went after and literally slaughtered them and, ended their heads to people. So that's on that. But I did, the sense that I get from your talk today, I was kind of pointing out this right there. A lot of the rhetoric that we've heard, especially the last couple of years with Israel being the aggressor in Lebanon and Palestine, particularly Gaza, et cetera, it seems like, from what you're saying, that the Arabian government, the ruling class there, would be more a lot of lip service for the Palestinians, saying, oh, yeah, we support you guys, but in reality, very much supporting, behind the scenes supporting you. Is that a correct assumption? Is one of you just have to be that pole or that hope for the Muslim world is, publicly look like, oh, we're against the U.S. and what they're doing to other Arab populations, but recognizing that Israel is actually a key foundation for almost all the Arab regimes in there, because knowing that Israel will help them keep their own people in line from overthrowing them, that's a correct analysis.
Okay, right here.
Well, I have another question. I was wondering, what your thoughts might be on Saudi Arabia's stake in Iraq. I think the obvious one is trying to counter the influence of Iran, and everybody has their favorite player inside Iraq. Mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia making sure that Iran doesn't have too strong a hand, but they have also been funding parts of the resistance that are attacking, like the U.S. in particular, so I'm wondering what your thoughts are. Is there an independent motive also of their own interests involved in Iraq, and also the Shia majority, and it just seems like this kind of soup.
Well, we all know that, of course, the media is terrible, and you were talking about how the way Saudi Arabia's gotten all sort of sudden attention, and there's this sort of hysteria around Saudi Arabia, but at the same time, like, if you look at the coverage of any oil, they're totally, it's a royal dictatorship, but they never mention it. I was wondering if it's more than just ideology and the way the press is, or if there are material interests of any of the big papers, the media conglomerates, in, you talked about investments in Saudi Arabia, or if there's any direct connection, or if it's just, a whole bunch of nonsense of the ruling class are talking to itself and, being convenient about leaving out, we're promoting democracy and we support democracy, but not there, that.
Just a couple points. I think Saudi Arabia, as you said, is very important for the United States to take a step back. I think the U.S. in the last half century has relied on a couple, in its combination of the Middle East, has relied on two things. On the one hand, Israel is the main ally, the most dependable ally of the United States in the region. That's the historic, unbreakable relationship that Obama has talked about. Mm-hmm. And the United States is also confident that the vast majority of the population in Israel will always back the United States, not just Israeli government. On the other hand, the U.S. relied on a nexus of allies of Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan in the 1950s and 1960s. These were the main allies. Now, after the defeat that the U.S. suffered in the 1979 revolution, after Egypt joined the U.S. camp in the 1970s, that nexus changed. The U.S. now relies on the trilogy of Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia as its main allies in the region. So Saudi Arabia is not the only country that you really need. They need Jordan and they need Egypt, and now they think they have Iraq as well. As a bulwark against any anti-American movement in the region. There's another point about the transition that happened after 1967, the rise of Islamic fundamentalism. This was actually a real thing. The defeat of Nasser in 1967 was not just a defeat for Arab secularism, for Arab nationalism. The left in general, the socialist and communist movements in the Middle East had actually supported Nasserism. So when Nasser was defeated in 67, this was actually seen as a defeat to the entire left. That gave an opening for organizations in the Middle East, such as the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, to actually make the argument that we've tried socialism and it failed. Now we should give Islam a chance. Saudi Arabia funneled a lot of money into this. And both Saudi Arabia and the Egyptian regime, for example, gave money to the Muslim Brotherhood, armed them against leftist students to break up the control of the left in universities across the Middle East. So it took about 10 years, really, to even defeat the left and for the Muslim Brotherhood to become the main political opposition in the whole region. And the last thing is that on I think there is a lot of poor people in Saudi Arabia, especially in the south of the country. The whole south of the country was stolen actually from Yemen. But the center of gravity of struggle in the Middle East, I don't think comes necessarily from the Gulf countries, where most of the population, most of the working classes are immigrant laborers and working under slave-type conditions. The center of gravity comes more from the north, from countries such as Egypt, from the Palestinian struggle, and from the struggle in Iraq against the occupation. That's what inspires, actually gives hope to immigrant workers and oppressed people inside.
And that's fine. There's plenty of stuff out there, but there's a lot of stuff to discuss. So we only actually have a couple people on the list. So, Sana?
I just wanted to see what your thoughts were on the 2002 Arab Peace Initiative, seeing as how Saudi Arabia was like one of the biggest still proponents of it, and what role you potentially think that's going to play in like the current administration and what Obama wants to do between Israel and Palestine. So I just wanted to see what role you think Saudi Arabia will play with that.
Okay, I've got Yusuf, and then I'm going to let Deepa come back on some of these.
Okay, well, I want to say a little something about the Palestine issue, but not the 2002 issue. But basically, yes, Saudi Arabia has paid a lot of lip service to the Palestine issue, while at the same time making sure that nobody can do any kind of organizing to support the Palestinians, even when like the Palestinians are organizing themselves abroad in Kuwait and other Gulf countries to form Qatar in the 60s. Saudi Arabia played a major role in making sure that their demands are somewhat limited, their activities are limited, and that whatever they do not jeopardize the stability of any of the Arab countries in which they're operating. But the other thing that Saudi Arabia did is that it wasn't just a political powerhouse, it was a financial powerhouse in the region. They could funnel, like using their immense financial resources, they were able to affect entire governments and movements in the area. And just, I'll give you an example, because I look at it from the prism of Lebanon, where I grew up, and Saudi money played a huge role in where we are today. Last year, when there was the major struggle between the opposition and the government in Lebanon, and you know, the Hezbollah-led opposition and the West, pro-Western government, where the opposition looked like it was going to destabilize the government was going to collapse, Saudi Arabia poured in millions of dollars into the central banking system to stabilize the government, stabilize the economy, and buy them more time so that you know the balance of power and forces shifted in favor of the pro-Western government, and they managed to survive. That would have been impossible without Saudi support. We just recently had elections in Lebanon last week, where you know, it was pretty much looking like it could be neck and neck, and the Saudis poured a lot of money again into the campaigns of the pro-Western government. Not only that, they even started up a Shia movement, a Shiite political party funded by the Saudis in opposition to the Hezbollah. They were also involved in funding all kinds of fundamentalist Sunni groups in Lebanon, which blew up into a major confrontation in the Palestinian camp, which the Lebanese army invaded last year as well. So, you know, just the way I just wanted to emphasize, I guess, the way that they, the financial resources that Saudi Arabia has majorly impacted what the region looks like. And that's another, that's how the U.S., you know, basically uses them as well.
Okay. I'll hand it back to Deepa, but feel free, if you, something occurs to you, raise your hand while she's speaking.
Right. I just want to talk a little bit about what Mustafa answered, and that is, why did secular nationalism, why did radical, you know, various countries around the world where this happens? In a nutshell, I think we should have a position which says there are internal reasons and there is the role of U.S. imperialism. It's not just one or the other. Now, the key thing to keep in mind is that secular nationalism in its various forms was always a middle class, a peri-bourgeois phenomenon. And ultimately, despite the radical promises and so on, and some of the regimes did carry through on land distribution, workers' rights, and so on and so forth, that's all true. But ultimately, they were trying to create their version of socialism in a capitalist, in a state capitalist manner. And the limitations of that model eventually caught up with them. And so, for instance, in Egypt, which was the shining beacon of Nasserism, actually unemployment began to grow, poverty began to increase, and so on. So the economic promise no longer existed. And then when Egypt got defeated in 1967 by Israel, their promise of creating Arab unity and actually defending the Palestinian homeland, even that was shattered. And so now people started to look to other alternatives and so on. Well, coincidentally and conveniently for the United States, there were other groups immediately there. And I say coincidentally in a completely ironical way, because in fact, from the 1950s, they had been involved in dialogues with the Muslim Brotherhood and Saudi Arabia. You know, under Nasser, many people in the Muslim Brotherhood were expelled. They go and set up home in Saudi Arabia. They then radicalize Wahhabism in particular kinds of ways. Then they come back under Anwar Sadat and so on and so forth. So this, the US has been integral to actually giving money to funding, supporting, training, et cetera, Islamist forces who come now and take over in the vacuum that's created. Now, in terms of the Saudi-Israeli relationship, you know, I'll just add a little bit to what was already said. Is it right to say that that Saudi Arabia only pays lip service to Palestinian causes? I don't think that's fully right. Because if you're going to be a ruler of any country in the Middle East, you can't rule, you can't have any legitimacy unless you support the Palestinian cause. This is the biggest wound, this is the biggest gash that has happened in that region. And so you have to, both rhetorically and to whatever extent, convince your domestic populations that you are doing what you can to come to the defense of Palestinian people. So what do? They try to contain the struggle in terms that are, you know, that suit them. So in fact, Saudi Arabia gave money to Fatah and to the PLO and so on and so forth, but in ways that they could manage and control you know, the kinds of strategies and so on. Because ultimately, if you think about it, Saudi Arabia has absolutely no interest in a Palestinian or in a working class uprising in the region, because the struggle against Zionism is necessarily tied in with the corrupt client regimes in all of these Arab countries who are going to start to see their own legitimacy and power be questioned by working classes. So Saudi Arabia, more than anybody else, is the most conservative kind of bloc in that region, trying to maintain the status quo. And that's why it poses in various sorts of ways and various initiatives, you know, 2002, all of that is simply about tamping and containing and maintaining the status quo. Very quickly on the Taliban, I mentioned earlier that, that Saudi Arabia, along with by South in the Pashtun area of the South, become refugees. They travel to various parts of Pakistan. And what happens is they wind up in schools, these Deobandi madrasas, and they're really ideologically the children of the Pakistani military and of the and sections of the Pakistani Islamist political parties and so on. Saudi Arabia's had all sorts of relationships with the Taliban, funding, not funding, and so on. But in general, if you look at, you know, the interest that Saudi Arabia, as well as countries like India and so on, have in that region, it's all about access to Caspian Sea oil, right? Because as we know, the U.S. is in Afghanistan. It wants bases there. It's a very geographically important region and so on. But ultimately, the world's greatest untapped source of oil and natural resources is in the Caspian Sea. And so everyone wants to have their horse in Afghanistan so that they can have a piece of the action in a post-war Afghanistan context. And finally, on the question, should I stop?
Keep going.
Okay, finally, on the question of the media and their failure to criticize what have you, I was looking for this quote. I have a quote somewhere, but I don't know if Saudi companies have any sort of direct economic stake in media corporations. I think that's an interesting question to investigate and find out. But the thing is, it's often less sort of direct than that as to why the media highlights certain things and don't highlight other things. Because if you look at what, you know, studies show, is that the political elite, the Democrats and the Republicans, set an agenda and the media just blindly follow it. And so that's what explains, you know, why in the 56 years that the US and Saudi Arabia have had this relationship, the coverage is almost non-existent, because the US actually wanted to keep their relationship with Saudi Arabia hidden, and the media dutifully obliged. Actually, one of the studies that we did in the context of my book is we use the word Islam wildcard, which means you can come up with things like Islamic, Islamism, Islamist, and Muslim spelt both ways, and Saudi Arabia. And you see in the case of Iran, you see in the case of Pakistan, you see in the case of all of these other countries, you get thousands of hits when you do this. You use those keywords in a LexisNexis search. You do it in the case of Saudi Arabia, you get about 30 or 40. So that really gives you a sense of how little the story of, you know, the way in which funds were used by Saudi Arabia to prop up all of these groups has completely not been told by the corporate media in this country.
Good. We have an open list, so still have several. Oh, great.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you. You mentioned just briefly the basically slave immigrant labor in Saudi Arabia that's present in much of the Gulf, and you know a lot of that is from South Asia and different places. So I want to know if I don't know if you can speak to maybe the possibilities for cooperation between those, immigrant laborers from, you know, who are like severely underpaid and work under these really horrible conditions, and whatever progressive left there is in Saudi Arabia, and I don't know, maybe in the wider Gulf.
Okay, go ahead.
There's sort of two. The United States was very effective with using proxies and manipulating economic conditions so that we didn't engage in direct conflict with Nasser, but at the same time presented him with a task he couldn't possibly succeed at. There was more curiosity expressed about that, but also about Saudi interests in Iraq. Do you think that the Saudis have basically learned from us this ability to use resources rather than intervening directly to create conditions during which an opposition to them just can't succeed in this kind of indirect way, and is that part of what we see them doing in Iraq and possibly also in other areas where, like, for example, the last thing the Saudis want is for the Palestinians to succeed in a way that might then give workers models or even just inspiration. So basically the Saudis learn from us and develop ways of acting independently from us, but on our model.
Mm-hmm. Guy all the way in the back?
No,
behind you.
I was wondering if you could touch on a relationship between the Bin Laden family and the Bush family.
Because there's just a few people on the list, I'm going to just make a very brief comment that Deepa mentioned the Fahrenheit 9/11, and I think, you know, a lot of that, I think, Michael Moore's point being that the U.S. and particularly the Bush administration like has financial interests with Saudi Arabia and therefore kind of like promotes, ignores their terrorist leanings and promotes them, you know, to the detriment of U.S. security. But I think it's much more complicated than that. I think the U.S. has seen that promoting the Saudi regime is very useful to them. Promoting a very conservative form of Islam has been very useful for them as an alternative to communism, has been an alternative to radicalism. But I think at the same time that a lot of the, they've not only funded the resistance in Afghanistan, or the Islamic groups in Afghanistan, but also, if I'm not correct, they funded Hamas in the beginning to quite a degree. And these groups are now, you know, huge thorns in the side of the United States, right? And not of the intent of Saudi Arabia. I think that people have used that Islamic discourse, I guess you could say, for more radical ends, for seeing that, you know, for anti-imperialism, and that's gotten out of control of Saudi Arabia to the extent that, like, now there's opposition groups in Saudi Arabia that take this Wahhabi format and take it to more radical ends and say, well, if you really believe all this, then you should be kicking the United States out and have an Islamic country free from these infidels. So it's really kind of gotten out of control, but I think the U.S. doesn't know how to stop. They still need to support the Saudi regime. They really don't see any alternative to that. If they're going to promote their ends of dominating the Middle East and keeping the opposition at bay.
Created a certain amount of instability since its formation. Deepa, kind of, I'm going to be repeating some of the stuff Deepa already said, but 50 years ago, the workforce in Saudi Arabia posed a fairly serious, you know, labor threat to, to capital in that country, and that's, you know, the danger posed by those early strikes and so on was consciously responded to both, you know, by the oil companies and by the Saudi ruling class by, you know, importing immigrant labor, very consciously segregating workers on the basis of language, and you have workers now in Saudi Arabia, but for a number of decades from as far away as, you know, South Korea and Southeast Asia and so on, and a whole range of sort of linguistic divisions and so on. There's an excellent book written on this by a woman named Helen Lackner who talks about how the oil fields were sort of consciously developed almost on these sort of nationally segregated lines to directly undermine the labor force and so on. But that's sort of something that they've been able to resolve. There's other internal contradictions within Saudi society which have been continuing to be problematic. One is the class inequality that Deepa spoke about. Unemployment right now is through the roof, particularly among young people in Saudi Arabia. The wealth that kind of sits at the top of society has forced continues to force the hand of repression from the top, but also the persecution of the Shia, which are about 10% of Saudi society, continue to sort of, you know, create these problems. And I think it's because there's, you know, some of this kind of instability and the fundamental lack of democracy from the regime, and it sort of forces these questions for its relationship with the U.S. You know, the U.S. has kind of tried to roll out a whole program of, you know, on the one hand, democratization of the Middle East and so on, and, you know, and as people have spoken to already, they continue to need Saudi Arabia despite all of that. And I think, Yusuf spoke about the regional sort of financial role. Another part of that, there's something new that Saudi Arabia has been doing recently, which is buying up huge tracts of agricultural land in strategically important places like in the Horn of Africa, Sudan, Ethiopia, and so on, Somalia, countries that are immensely impoverished and really and drought-stricken, and which this, you know, and actually Egypt is doing this too, along with Saudi Arabia, but in which they can have almost, you know, not really like a sub-imperial power, but they're strengthening their sort of regional economic and political hand. But the recent economic crisis in this country has meant that sovereign funds, which is investment, from Saudi Arabia, have been, you know, incredibly important. And I don't know, maybe Deepa could say something more. So I think that Saudi Arabia, can I have one more sound? Is that oil from Saudi Arabia is actually really like continuing to lower in terms of its supply to the U.S. And so that there's just a whole other web of relations that is very key for.
Okay, go ahead.
I
just had a quick question. You talked a little bit in the beginning about how the U.S. kind of maneuvered to cut Britain out of, you know, being an influential power there. I'm curious, today, does the U.S., are they basically the only imperial power that kind of has a lock on Saudi Arabia and has power and influence in the region, or Europe, China, do these other countries?
The discovery of oil and the massive development that happened in Saudi Arabia and in the rest of the Gulf was a godsend thing, not just for the Saudi royal family, but for the ruling classes in the Arab world and later on in Pakistan and Bangladesh, in the sense that all these regimes that failed to develop a strong national economy were able in the 1950s and 60s to export their problem outside, to send millions of workers to Saudi Arabia, to Kuwait, to the United Arab Emirates, and to ease the problem of unemployment in those countries. So that's where people said, people went there, learned, you know, having as long, but actually people went there and that was really good for the regimes. They could send money back, that could help the regimes in Egypt and Syria. There were tons of Palestinian refugees in Saudi Arabia, by the way, they're the ones who led the strikes in the oil fields in Saudi Arabia in 1956. They were banned from the oil field for the next 10 years. So that was really good for those regimes. It allowed those regimes some breathing space. People, you know, could maybe try to find a job in Saudi Arabia, maybe I'll go to Kuwait. By the 80s, 90s, that has begun to change, and make a long story short, within the international economic crisis that we live in, actually Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries are no longer accepting any foreign labor, they're cutting down on labor, and that increases the level of the crisis in countries like Egypt, Palestine, Syria, Lebanon. So we have to look at it, you know, also from that point of view. The final thing on the migrant labor thing is that in Dubai, for example, there are demonstrations, strikes by Bangladeshi workers against terrible conditions, 16-hour work days, no drinking water. Same things happen in Saudi Arabia. The problem is that the labor force is not an immigrant labor force. People go there just for 2 or 3 years to make some money and want to go back home. So it's very different from, you know, the labor force is more transient. It doesn't mean that you won't struggle. It doesn't mean that those struggles are not important. But those struggles have to be connected and have, you know, in solidarity with general struggles in the area to be effective.
I think the recent brief on interest in the media in Saudi Arabia, I think, fits into some of the other kind of ideological contradictions that are opening up in the United States and around the world. You know, for instance, certain politicians find it useful to, you know, bash China and kind of that relationship, but yet the United States depends heavily on China. Same thing with immigrant labor, like bashing immigrants for this, but yet our economy is very much fundamentally dependent on immigrant labor. And the same thing goes with Saudi Arabia, as now some politicians favor bashing Saudi Arabia, we need to get off foreign oil, but yet they have one, no clear plan to actually do anything about it, but two, it actually opens up a scrutiny on a country that they'd rather not have, and I think this fits in. You know, for instance, the 60 Minutes piece that happened maybe 6 months ago on the settlements in the West Bank, I mean, I think you can start to see the kind of contradictions that they really don't have necessarily control over, but this economic crisis puts into the mix, and I think Saudi Arabia fits into this overall picture too, and I think you can see, you're going to need to see more and more of this kind of thing, the media beginning to look at things and people in this country begin to question things that have been festering for years and years and years, but now because of this conflagration of you know, Obama and the media and the economic crisis, that you begin to analyze these things in a much deeper way. And it provides opening for, I think, groups like us and conferences like this to really insert ourselves in a way we've never been able to. So I'm really glad we had this talk in order to kind of fill in some of this maybe 60-year gap in history in this country.
Two more speakers, and then after that, we're going to turn it back to Deepa. Okay, go ahead in the back.
Yeah, I guess just
next to you.
Oh, sorry.
Next to you, and then you're next.
I was wondering about the effects of U.S. bases in Saudi Arabia and how that affected like the Middle East and stuff, having bases in the Holy Land.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
If you could just comment, I guess, on, you always hear about what has been done and what is being done. Currently, I'd like to, can you chart out somewhere between a realistic and a socialist approach that would that could get us the best case scenario with the shit that is really good, with the actual reality of the situation in, say, 10, 15 years? Like, assuming we're trying to get away from the relationship.
That's a good question.
With Saudi Arabia and or get a better, more pluralistic government in that country. I don't know. What is the goal? That's what I'm saying. What do you think? Could you comment on that?
Good question. Okay.
What was the exact question? Is what, other than a socialist revolution,
what do you see as a realistic alternative in 10 or 15 years that would be good, you know, other than like
right.
world revolution?
Got it. Okay. I'll start with, I guess, the question of the U.S. and Nasser. I'm not sure I fully understood that question, that the U.S. did not engage with Nasser. That's actually not true, because the U.S. did try to co-opt Nasser initially, but it didn't work. And then after that, they actually had all sorts of plans to take him out. The CIA actually, there's a book by Robert Dreyfus called Devil's Game, and he documents how the CIA, for instance, tried to do even ridiculous things like put poison into his chocolates, exploding cigars, and you know, stuff like that to take him out. So there's been a sort of direct involvement by the U.S.
I should have said successfully.
Okay. Okay. And also keep in mind that the U.S. Intervened on Egypt's side during the Suez Crisis in 1956. France, Britain, and Israel invaded Egypt, and the only reason why they were held back is because the U.S. intervened on the side of Egypt. Of course, this had very little to do with Egypt and more to do with the U.S. actually establishing its hegemony in the region and getting the old imperial powers to get out of the way. And I think someone had a question about that, but I can't remember what that question was. Was it how did the U.S. get rid of Britain, or I don't remember what that question was. Well, if that's the question, is how did the U.S. supersede Britain's role in the region? Well, first of all, Britain was deeply weakened by the Second World War. It was economically devastated. The U.S. had to bring in the Marshall Plan to help reconstruct Europe and so on. And the relationship between Britain and the United States when it comes to various countries around the world has been a sort of diplomatic dance. You know, there's some give, there's some take, and so on. The U.S. has intervened whenever it could to edge Britain out. And so directly in the case of Saudi Arabia, there's some disputed territory in the north in Buraimi, and the U.S. comes in on the side of Saudi Arabia rather than the British. And slowly, in those sorts of ways, it manages to replace, in many ways, the old colonial powers. This does not mean that Britain and France and so on don't have ties and relationships and so on with countries in the region they seize. To Saudi Arabia and so on. So there are all sorts of relationships that Saudi Arabia has forged. Now, in terms of the Bin Laden and the Bush family, I mean, I don't know anything more about their personal relationship than what we've seen in Fahrenheit 9/11. You know, people have talked about a close relationship between Bush Sr. and Prince Bandar, who came here. He had access to the White House. He could just go in whenever he wanted. The same sort of close relationship didn't exist, for instance, with Clinton. But I think this really obfuscates the history of the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia, because I think what Michael Moore gets wrong is he sees personality politics as somehow superseding the economic and political interests that the two countries have had, regardless of whether they're chummy with each other or have personal relationships and so on. So I think that's in many ways a sort of red herring in terms of understanding this. And you know, Fahrenheit 9/11, frankly, was a film plugging the Democrats. This was a film that ended with, we've got to get rid of Bush and we've got to get the Democrats. And quite frankly, as I've pointed out, you know, whether you're talking about Truman, whether you're talking about FDR, whether you're talking about Johnson, whether you're talking about Carter, the relationship, in fact, has not been different when the Democrats have been in power as when the Republicans have been in power. Finally, on the question of worker struggles, I think, you know, people have made a lot of good comments. I'll just add a few more to this, and that is, remember what I said about Saudi Arabia in the 1950s. They didn't actually have enough workers at that point to work in this in the oil industry. They had to actually get people from elsewhere to come in and work and so on. So in addition to this being a sort of labor dividing tactic, it was also just a complete necessity in order to sustain the kind of economic growth that they wanted to. But one of the other things that they did, in addition to the things that Lee mentioned, is that they divided the indigenous working class from the immigrant working class by giving the indigenous working class more sort of cushy white collar jobs, whereas the more manual, menial kind of jobs went to immigrant workers. And of course, all of this was done specifically to drive wedges between workers and so forth. Now, in terms of you know, the progressive left and you know, what prospects are there for something in the next 10 to 15 years and so on. Maybe this is a limitation of my research, but I really, really hunted to see if there are any progressive forces. I really hunted to see if there are any you know, worker struggles. And I came across, you know, the stuff that Mustafa mentioned in Dubai. There are strikes in Bahrain, and so on and so forth. And, you know, there are tiny presence of progressive activity and so on. But for the most part, in Saudi Arabia, the opposition today to the Saudi regime comes mainly, unfortunately, from the Islamists. The movement that I mentioned earlier of the Islamist right wing has its origins in the 60s, the high point in 79. And then what happens is that instead of crushing them in exactly the same way as they crushed the left, what the Saudi regime did is they co-opted their program, which led to a further growth of confidence of these people. So that in 91, someone asked about bases. The US lands in Saudi Arabia, puts soldiers on that base, and that becomes a huge, Saudi Arabian women organize this drive-in, if you will. They go to a mall, the parking lot in a mall, and they take their cars and they all drive in circles to make a point. Saudi Arabia women don't have the right to drive. A car. So this was a way of trying to win that. And, you know, the regime in cahoots with the Sahwa movement clamps down. The women are placed under virtual house arrest. They're dismissed from their jobs. Their passports are revoked and so on and so forth. So I wish I could say that there is the beginnings of a progressive left and the beginnings of some sort of fight back at this point. But I couldn't actually find anything related to that. And that's why I think a point that was made earlier, which is that there's a way in which, you know, post-Ottoman Arab and Persian lands were divided up in these really artificial ways to create nations which were convenient for imperial powers. But the memory of a collective Arab identity still exists. And so in that sense, strikes and workers' activities in Egypt, strikes and workers' activities in other countries and so on, actually have a huge impact on the consciousness of people everywhere. And I think it's to Egypt and it's to, you know, even Iran, I think, that we need to look to in terms of workers' movements and progressive movements actually leading the way forward. And I'll just stop there.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.